everyone, welcome to Money Trail with me, Amir Arafat. Today, the two Bretton Woods institutions of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the New World Order.
Preparing to rebuild the international economic system as World War II was still raging, 730 delegates from all 44 allied nations gathered at the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, the United States, for the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference. The conference was held from the 1st to 22nd of July, 1944, when the agreements were signed to set up the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, and the International Monetary Fund. However, what most of the signatories did not know was that the document they had just signed was the result of some 3 years of intense behind-the-scenes negotiations between the declining British Empire and a rising American Empire. The agreement for a new Anglo-American world order based on U.S. supremacy was indeed first discussed in a secret meeting from the 9th to 12th of August 1941 between British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt on a ship in the North Atlantic, all against the backdrop of a just-begun World War II. The Bretton Woods Conference was indeed called after some 2.5 years of clause-by-clause planning by the treasuries of the US and the UK.
The World Bank and the IMF were creations after a sense of redevelopment program that was engineered by British and American economists and politicians and bankers in order to get more capital to redevelop some of the developed and developing nations after the wars. It was mainly engineered through the Bretton Woods scheme, and what the main things that came out from that, which was built upon Keynesian economics, an economist from UK, was an emergence of a gold-backed currency and the emergence of institutions, which later became known as the World Bank and later the International Monetary Fund.
Indeed, the timing of the conference could not have been more carefully worked out, since the war-weary participants had zero bargaining power to challenge the dictates of the Anglo-American Axis. Although attended by 44 nations, discussions at the conference were dominated by two rival plans developed by the U.S. and Britain. As the chief international economist at the U.S. Treasury in 1942-44, Harry Dexter White drafted the U.S. blueprint for international access to liquidity, which competed with the plan drafted for the British Treasury by John Maynard Keynes. Keynes' proposals would have established a world reserve currency, which he thought might be called Bancor, administered by a central bank vested with the possibility of creating money and with the authority to take actions on a much larger scale. But the United States, as a likely creditor nation, and eager to take on the role of a world's economic powerhouse, balked at Keynes' plan and did not pay serious attention to it, although compromise was reached in some points because of the overwhelming economic and military power of the United States. The participants at Bretton Woods largely agreed on White's plan. U.S. allies, economically exhausted by the war, needed U.S. assistance to rebuild their domestic production and finance their international trade. Indeed, they needed it to survive. Without a strong European market for U.S. goods and services, most policymakers believed the U.S. economy would be unable to sustain the prosperity it had achieved during the war. Hence the birth of the so-called Marshall Plan for Europe, through which the United States lent or granted billions of dollars building the devastated European infrastructure and economy in exchange for Europe's submission to U.S. hegemony. As unilateral and unjust as the Europeans perceived the deal, their lot was indeed incomparably better than that of the Third World and developing nations, who were to be robbed of every bit of their natural resources, not to mention political autonomy and national sovereignty, in exchange for hefty IMF World Bank loans granted only after the recipient states surrendered to so-called structural adjustments that included, among other things, privatization and deregulation, in fact opening the door to total takeover by giant U.S. corporations and conglomerates.
Well, the colonials left, and you had countries like Ghana and Nigeria becoming independent. But of course, they needed infrastructural loans to build up their countries. So unfortunately for them, to enable them to build up those kind of infrastructures, they needed to take out loans. And what happened to the rest of the country? What happened to the rest of the manifesto? What happened to the people? What happened to building up your own national pride, your own national organizations, your own national businesses? Therefore, you were letting in people come in who could then take over your newly privatized organizations, mostly American companies, because what you're looking for is a way to generate income. if you're told that you're not at a stage where you can actually provide that and you need to take instruction from other countries who can actually tell you how to run your country properly, and that's a condition of your loan, you're more likely to take that loan. And once you've taken that loan, you have all of the credentials that go with it that you have to abide by. Suddenly you have debt around your neck and you now have to repay it, and you've now got foreigners in your country running your country.
It was meant to be the lender of last resort. It was meant to stabilize global economy. But with the loans came great expectations. Yes, we're talking about the International Monetary Fund and structural adjustment programs that not only failed to stabilize global economy, rather destabilized many markets around the world.
But the way that the IMF and the World Bank is sold to people and the general public is that it's a union between pooling together money in order to bail out and support developing countries and redistribute some money from the wealthy nations to the less well-off nations. Unfortunately, it's completely opposite in reality.
Just as the Federal Reserve keeps the American public in a position of indentured servitude through perpetual debt, inflation, and interest, the World Bank and IMF serve this role on a global scale.
When you look at the effects of the IMF and the World Bank, essentially, through special powers and charters, they have the ability to create money pretty much backed by nothing. Although, you know, members of the IMF, the member countries, are meant to be depositing gold and giving some contributions, the reality is that they're creating new currencies and issuing new loans, which are backed by pretty much nothing, and then using that money in order to not support developing countries, but in order to find a new market for their debt.
The basic scam is simple. Put a country in debt, either by its own indiscretion or through corrupting the leader of that country. Then impose conditionalities or structural adjustment policies, often consisting of the following. Currency devaluation. When the value of a currency drops, so does everything valued in it. This makes indigenous resources available to predator countries at a fraction of their worth. Large funding cuts for social programs. These usually include education and healthcare, compromising the well-being and integrity of the society, leaving the public vulnerable to exploitation.
You're not giving money to education because that money is going into another pool that's going to pay off your debt. You're not spending money on healthcare. You're not spending money on the infrastructure that you said that you wanted. And it's having an adverse effect because the people aren't getting what they want. And when the people are unhappy, you have things like wars. You have things like infrastructural breakdown, and people start to think that you're not looking after them. If you're not looking after them, they start to feel disenfranchised. And what do? They pick up the gun.
What the IMF and the World Bank have done for decades is participate in the demise of countries all over the world. It seems to be the U.S. foreign policy that when they want to take over a country, they've used different types of methods going to war, but one that is very effective is the IMF and the World Bank will loan money to countries. And they obviously cannot afford to pay it back, so what they do is they go after resources. They've done that a lot in the South American countries, and they're doing that extensively in the Middle Eastern countries.
And now, confessions of an economic hitman. John Perkins explains what the U.S. has been doing to the entire world through the IMF and World Bank.
We economic hitmen really have been the ones responsible for creating this first truly global empire. And we work many different ways. But perhaps the most common is that we will identify a country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to our big corporations to build infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, ports, things that benefit a few rich people in that country, in addition to our corporations, but really don't help the majority of the people at all. However, those people, the whole country is left holding a huge debt. It's such a big debt they can't repay it, and that's part of the plan. They can't repay it. And so at some point, we economic hitmen go back to them and say, listen, you lost a lot of money, can't pay your debts, so sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies, allow us to build a military base in your country, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world like Iraq, or vote with us on the next UN vote, to have their electric utility company privatized and their water and sewage system privatized and sold to US corporations or other multinational corporations. So there was that whole mushrooming thing, and it's so typical of the way the IMF and the World Bank work, that you put a country in debt, it's such a big debt it can't pay it, and then you offer to refinance that debt and pay even more interest. And you demand this quid pro quo, which you call a conditionality or good governance, which means basically that they've got to sell off their resources, including many of their social services, their utility companies, their school systems sometimes, their penal systems, their insurance systems, to foreign corporations. So it's a double, triple, quadruple whammy.
That's what I've been writing about most recently in my articles, is how the IMF and the World Bank have taken what happened in Serbia in the 1980s and used that as a template. The International Republican Institute, the IRI, went into Serbia and spoke with KOPTOR, which is the revolution that took down the government there, and learned from them how to use a fake revolution in order to use the people to call for quote-unquote democracy, which really means that they're coming in to take over your country, and once the government is dissolved, they will go ahead and install their patsy. And that seems to be the modus operandi of the World Bank and the IMF, because it's so successful. They don't have to instigate a war. They can have the people unknowingly call for their own tyranny. And then once the patsy is installed and the IMF has them economically, that nation economically, then they control the resources because the country can't afford to pay them back. So they're forced to give up their resources to the international community.
Privatization of state-owned enterprises. This means that socially important systems can be purchased and regulated by foreign corporations for profit. For example, in 1999, the World Bank insisted that the Bolivian government sell the public water system of its third largest city to a subsidy of the U.S. corporation Bechtel. As soon as this occurred, water bills for the already impoverished local residents skyrocketed. It wasn't until after a full-blown revolt by the people that the Bechtel contract was nullified. Then there is trade liberalization, or the opening up of the economy through removing any restrictions on foreign trade. This allows for a number of abusive economic manifestations, such as transnational corporations bringing in their own mass-produced products, undercutting the indigenous production and ruining local economies. An example is Jamaica, which, after accepting loans and conditionalities from the World Bank, lost its largest cash crop markets due to competition with Western imports. Today, countless farmers are out of work, for they are unable to compete with the large corporations.
And now to a continent most familiar with the largesse of both U.S.-led institutions, the World Bank and the IMF. Of course, we're talking Africa.
Most African countries have national products that are developed traditionally in their countries, but the market's been completely marginalized by having tariffs that work to the Western economies so that they can actually pay rock-bottom prices for these products and services, and actually are subsidized in their own countries so that they don't actually lose out. But the farmers, the local farmers who are, sort of tiling their trade and making sure that they're, growing the crops that are actually going to benefit their families, are being sold down the river.
Many of the African nations and many of the African countries have been subject to behavior where, as we said, the IMF and the World Bank finding new markets for their debts, finding new markets to issue loans, which was money that was essentially created by the banking system. And in finding these new markets, they've tried to get an agenda across at the same time as issuing these loans. Because when they reach unsustainable rates, which they cannot pay, you're seeing many examples of them having to accept foreign companies to come and set up base within that country, or tied loans whereby in order to actually in order for us to issue the loan, you have to accept and you have to purchase many of our exports.
Another variation is the creation of numerous seemingly unnoticed, unregulated, inhumane sweatshop factories, which take advantage of the imposed economic hardship. Additionally, due to production deregulation, environmental destruction is perpetual, as a country's resources are often exploited by the indifferent corporations while outputting large amounts of deliberate pollution.
The largest environmental lawsuit in the history of the world today is being brought on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorian Amazonian people against Texaco, which is now owned by Chevron. So today it's against Chevron, but for activities conducted by Texaco. Estimated to be more than 18 times what Exxon Valdez dumped into the coast of Alaska. In the case of Ecuador, it wasn't an accident. The oil companies did it intentionally. They knew they were doing it to save money out there rather than arranging for a proper disposal.
IMF's sister institution, the World Bank, was supposed to help develop a world ruined after two world wars, especially after World War II, with the help of the U.S. and its dollars. But loans came with a hefty price and heftier expectations than the U.S. side.
A cursory glance at the performance record of the World Bank reveals that the institution, which publicly claims to help poor countries develop and alleviate poverty, has done nothing but increase poverty and the wealth gap.
The IMF and the World Bank are really pretty much extensions of the unsustainable banking system that was first founded in the UK and then exported to the States and then exported around the world. And the way that the banking system has been engineered is that it's not actually the way that it's sold to us. And the way that the banking system is sold to us is that it's this vital institution that puts together people that have money and collects together people's savings and then lends that out to people that need to borrow it and lends savers money. Which is a nice theory, but it's not in fact how the banking system works. The way the banking system actually works is that first a loan is issued and then a deposit is created. Now, what's the difference? Well, the difference being is that because a loan can be issued without having a deposit, essentially the banking system is the creators of money. Now, let's extend that out to the IMF and the World Bank. The IMF and the World Bank are extensions of the unsustainable banking system that was, as we said, first developed in the UK and then exported through the States. And what it is, it's unsustainable global banking on an international scale.
While corporate profits soar. In 1960, the income gap between the fifth of the world's people in the richest countries versus the fifth in the poorest countries was 30-1. By 1998, it was 74-1. While global GNP rose 40% between 1970 and 1985, those in poverty actually increased by 17%. While from 1985 to 2000, those living on less than $1 a day increased by 18%. Even the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress admitted that there is a mere 40% success rate of all World Bank projects. In the late 1960s, the World Bank intervened in Ecuador with large loans. During the next 30 years, poverty grew from 50% to 70%. Under or unemployment grew from 15 to 70%. Public debt increased from 240 million to 16 billion. While the share of resources allocated to the poor went from 20% to 6%. In fact, by the year 2000, 50% of Ecuador's national budget had to be allocated for paying its debts. It is important to understand the World Bank is, in fact, a U.S. bank supporting U.S. interests, for the United States holds veto power over decisions as it is the largest provider of capital. And where did it get this money? You guessed it, it made it out of thin air through the fractional reserve banking system.
The World Bank and the IMF are two separate. They mostly rely on what America's thinking, what America's doing, even with who they recruit as their head. They need to start looking at the policies that people who directly work in countries that have inequality and poverty are working towards when they're budgeting and working at the financial policies of their own countries. Those types of collaborations, those types of partnerships, even if it is just to reform what's going on with the World Bank and the IMF, to just have them consider, have them come to the table and talk to people, and that there's some kind of will to do that. That would be absolutely fantastic. What's missing is the fact that they won't talk, they won't recruit anybody that's going to have any say on how to run a poverty-stricken country or has any experience.
The U.S. built the IMF not as a democratic institution, rather as a plutocratic foundation after its own image at home, where economic and financial might is right, and it's a system of voting rights among governments, not as a one-state, one vote, but rather in proportion to quotas depending which nation had contributed more funds. And since the United States was contributing the most, U.S. leadership was self-evident. Under the system of weighted voting, the United States exerted a preponderant influence on the IMF. The United States held one-third of all IMF quotas at the outset, enough on its own to veto all the changes to the IMF charter. In addition, the IMF was based in Washington, D.C. and staffed mainly by U.S. economists. It regularly exchanged personnel with the U.S. Treasury.
I'm a Nigerian. We had our finance minister go for the role. We had people who've got financial backgrounds in poverty and inequality, and they're not given any kind of opportunity to engage. And I'd just like to see more engagement. I'd like to see them challenge and have a non-American in the IMF. I'd really like them to have even African or Latin American who has direct experience of what's going on in 45% of the world, and for them to have that balanced out on any of the policies that they're coming out with.
Of the world's top 100 economies, as based on annual GDP, 51 are corporations, and 47 of that 51 are US-based. Walmart, General Motors, and Exxon are more economically powerful than Saudi Arabia, Poland, Norway, South Africa, Finland, Indonesia, and many others. And as protective trade barriers are broken down, currencies tossed together and manipulated in floating markets, and state economies overturned in favor of open competition and global capitalism, the empire expands.
It's one thing when a government and a national banking system racks up tremendous debt. There's a massive difference between a national debt and a debt to another country. Because when you're in debt to another country or another institution like the IMF and the World Bank, you lose the democratic power, the sovereign power, the sovereignty of the nation.
The World Bank works with the Bank of International Settlements, which is the top dog as far as the technocratic control. They have decided by 2019, they have decided that all the central banks have to liquidate. So we're seeing a massive move by the central banks and the technocrats to take over the countries using sovereign debt. And this goes back to what we're talking about. Sovereign debt is a part of it. When you want to take over a country and you don't want to have a war, you can destroy them economically by forcing on debt that the people did not incur. The central banks incurred the debt.
But that was then. And this is now. Some 7 decades on, we're talking 21st century now and a world desperate for a new order.
Many analysts refer to the monetary system of today as Bretton Woods II. In the wake of the global financial crisis of 2008, policymakers and others have called for a new international monetary system that some of them also dub Bretton Woods II.
The status quo will eventually change. Nothing stays the same. The BRIC countries are coming, and they're coming because they're reacting to what people want. They're reacting to what the market wants. I'm so excited to know that there is someone, a group out there like the BRIC bloc that wants to do something and can and is trying to grow so they can challenge the World Bank and the IMF.
Well, thank you for watching. Always follow the money trail with me, Amir Arfa.